Today, I interview Lisa Hendrickson-Jack, author of The Fifth Vital Sign and co-author of Real Food for Fertility, all about our monthly cycles, how they are considered our fifth vital sign, and how we can use them as a form of birth control, prior to and even after pregnancy. We discuss how cycle tracking and the fertility awareness method is a great choice to prevent pregnancy and help you conceive when you're ready without the side effects or transition time of hormonal contraceptives. I loved interviewing Lisa and can't wait to share it with you. Let's get started. Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes. I'm so excited to interview Lisa today. She is a certified fertility awareness educator and holistic reproductive health practitioner who trains women's health practitioners to use their menstrual cycle as a vital sign in their practices. She is the founder of the Fertility Awareness Mastery Mentorship Program. She is the author of three best-selling books, Real Food for Fertility, co-authored with Lily Nichols, The Fifth Vital Sign, and the Fertility Awareness Mastery Charting Workbook. Lisa works tirelessly to debunk the myth that regular ovulation is only important when you want children by recognizing the menstrual cycle as a vital sign. Drawing heavily from the current scientific literature, Lisa presents an evidence-based approach to help women connect to their fifth vital sign by uncovering the connection between the menstrual cycle, fertility, and overall health, something our education systems have consistently failed to do. With well over 4 million downloads, her podcast, Fertility Friday, is the number one source for information about fertility awareness and menstrual cycle health. When she's not researching, writing, and mentoring women's health professionals, you'll find her spending time with her husband, her two sons, and her baby girl. To learn more, visit fertilityfriday.com. All right, Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. We're so thrilled to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So before we jump into kind of the content, can you just share with our listeners a little bit about what got you interested in periods and cycles and fertility and just all the things that you teach about? Can you just kind of speak to that? I always love hearing people's stories.
Yes, for sure. Well, I will try to keep it brief. But basically, in my case, my very first period from like when I started menstruating was heavy and painful. And that led me on an interesting journey. I went to my doctor and asked to be put on the pill because girls talk, and that was word on the street that that would help. And so when I went on the pill, I found that my pill periods, my kind of withdrawal bleeds, I didn't know the language at the time, were actually more manageable. And so every now and then I would come off of the pill wondering if I was really fixed, only to find out that I really wasn't fixed and my actual periods would come back with a vengeance. So that put it on my radar at a really young age. Like, I didn't have the knowledge or anything like that, but I had the sense that there was something wrong. Like, it shouldn't be like that because my friends weren't like on the floor when they had their periods in pain. And so when I actually needed birth control, because when I used the pill in high school, I wasn't actively using it for birth control, I decided to come off the pill. And I wanted to try to figure out what was going on, even though I had like no information. And so it was around that time that I discovered fertility awareness. And so that really just threw me down a whole new rabbit hole. It was really empowering to discover that I was not fertile every day. And given that I had decided to come off the pill and use condoms, it really helped me to feel a lot more confident about that decision, because then I was able to understand when I was fertile in my cycle and when I wasn't. And I was able to use that for birth control in my late teens, early 20s, up until I had my first child, when my husband and I were trying. So I was able to take that information for granted for a really long time. And somewhere along my path, I mean, when I first started charting, it was just for birth control. And then at some point, one of my charting instructors looked at my chart and she was like, "Your temperatures are too low and your cycles are too long. I think you should get your thyroid checked." Mm-hmm. And so that blew my mind again, because I'm thinking, like, how does this woman look at like these temperature spikes and my mucus patterns and identify that I could have like an underlying issue? So, you know, obviously the title of my first book, The Fifth Vital Sign, like that was kind of my entrance or second entrance into fertility awareness turning, because I learned that the cycle is really just a marker of your health as well. And so, you know, fast forward to when I had my first son, I kind of looked around and realized that I was able to take this information for granted for a decade. And I was observing how many women were struggling to conceive. And although I had changed, the world was still the same. And the average woman has no idea about her cycle, how it works, how to confirm when she's ovulating and all that kind of stuff. So that was what prompted me to start my podcast and eventually write the books and all the things.
Oh, I love that. That's amazing. And I think if I could wave a magic wand and have something change in the world, it's that all women, as soon as they get their periods, are taught this information, because I think it's so crazy and silly that we don't know it when it's happening to us every month. And it dictates so much of our lives, how we feel, what our health is doing, preventing pregnancy, getting pregnant. It's crazy that it's a mystery. It shouldn't be a mystery. It should be known like the back of our hand. So thank you for doing the work that you do in the world.
Thanks. Yeah, I often think, like, in high school, I learned a whole lot of information about my ear and like my eyes, which is good. I'm not saying it's bad, but day-to-day functionality of learning about your menstrual cycle takes it to a whole new level. Like, we should be learning about that.
Yeah. Oh, I think we learn about a lot of useless things in school, you know, aren't even, I mean, calculus. I mean, why are we all taking calculus? I never used calculus. I was very good at it, but I never used it. And I studied it so hard.
Because of my weird math brain, but like, what is it doing for me today?
Literally nothing. And I spent so long, you know, trigonometry, calculus, like, not that math is like the most useless. I think there were other more useless things that I learned that I'm like, gosh, if I could have just plugged in how to make, you know, take care of my health, how to have a menstrual cycle, I think everyone would just be better. But that's amazing. Okay, so can you tell our audience, for people who just don't know, what do you mean by the period being the fifth vital sign? And like the importance of our cycle, you touched on it a little bit with it, you know, pulling in things about your thyroid and stuff, but can you just speak to that briefly?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so a vital sign is simply a measure of how our body is functioning. And the most common vital signs are things like our basal body temperature, our body temperature, our blood pressure, our heart rate, our respiratory rate. And so when you go to the doctor and they test for any of those main vital signs, not only does it give some general information. So for example, if your blood pressure is too high or too low, it tells your doctor something's up, but it also provides a more kind of specific window of information, because there's certain things that could cause low blood pressure versus high. So it gives them not only just a general sense, but more of a specific sense. And it's interesting because we don't necessarily think of our menstrual cycle in this way. The way that our culture thinks about our menstrual cycle, it's just this annoying thing that happens. It's frustrating. And we often have a really negative view of it. And with the birth control industry and all of those things associated with it, I feel like we really just think of it only as related to reproduction. So what's interesting is that if you observe the menstrual cycle, and not just your period, but all the different phases of the cycle. So, you know, your period, the first day of your period marks the first day of your cycle. And if we go through the cycle, you know, in the first half, that's your pre-ovulatory phase. And if you're tracking some of those main markers that I, you know, teach my clients to track, like cervical fluid or basal body temperature, all those different markers, you can start to see different patterns. So within your menstrual cycle, there's a number of different parameters that you can track. And so similar to the other vital signs, it's not just that if your cycle is too long or too short, or if your mucus patterns are off, or if your, you know, the second half of your cycle, the luteal phase, is too short. It does give a general sense that something's up. But for someone who's versed in this concept, it can also give some specific indications as to, you know, what we should be looking at, like what could be off. So it's really interesting for women who do track their cycles, especially for women who track their cycles over time, because you can start to see how kind of minor day-to-day things can have an effect, but also kind of more major health things can have an effect. And so if we take that concept, and it's not just, I didn't make this up. This wasn't necessarily my idea. There's a number of organizations that are calling for this. So for example, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the American Academy of Pediatrics, they're kind of coming together to say that we should use the menstrual cycle as a vital sign, often in particular when they're looking at teens. So if you have a doctor who's, you have a teen coming into the office and, you know, she's 17 years old and she hasn't had her period yet. Like, that's a huge flag that we should be looking at what's going on. So there is a growing movement and I'm merely highlighting it because obviously it's important and it's really fascinating what you can learn by just paying attention to what's happening in the cycle.
Yeah. I love that. And I think it's just so needed, you know, in our medical world. Obviously, us as naturopathic doctors, we have always kind of considered the menstrual cycle as a very vital part of our analysis of people. And, you know, just off the bat, if someone tells me about their period, if their flow is heavy or light, I mean, I immediately start having ideas about what their hormonal picture looks like. I mean, it's just so simple, but there's so much more information that you can learn, which is amazing. So is it true that all women's cycles should kind of be the same, right? We have a lot of variation in our bodies and as people and, you know, everyone's like, well, everyone's unique and individual, but is there a normal menstrual cycle? Should it be that everyone has a certain pattern and a certain type of period and all of these nuances and differences among women as far as when they ovulate or when their period comes or how long it is or how heavy it is? Are these all clues and signs or is it just individual variation?
I love that question. I feel like there's a little bit of both in a way. So I'll start by sharing just what I think is a funny anecdote. So you can tell me if you think it's funny. But when I started charting my cycles, I had read Taking Charge of Your Fertility, which is an amazing resource. And it's a resource that most people, I would say, find fertility awareness through this resource. But I remember when she was talking about the different cycles, she provided an example of like a short cycle, kind of normal cycle and a long cycle. And I have already mentioned that my cycles were on the long side. So my average cycle length when I was charting in my early 20s was 38 days. And a healthy range for a menstrual cycle is somewhere between 24 to 35 days, typically, with an average of about 29 days. But my cycle was consistently more than that. And I remember at the time being a child, like I was in my early 20s. So I remember just thinking like, oh, I'm Lisa and I have long cycles. You know, like I don't need to follow this. Like it was kind of, I was also in this like post-high school feminist phase, you know, so I was like doing my own thing. And so this is a mistake. So to answer your question, there are cycles as women shouldn't all be the same because that's ridiculous. They're not all going to be the same. But we do want to recognize that there's a healthy range that cycles should fall into. And so that concept I think is helpful to a lot of women because since we have been trained to believe that all menstrual cycles should always be 28 days, there are a lot of women whose cycles might be 27 days or 32 days, and they might think that they have a problem because they think that that makes their cycles irregular. So we can go through some of those parameters if you'd like, but generally speaking, I've already mentioned the overall length typically falls somewhere between 24 and 35 days. And if we break it down further, before I break it down further, I should mention that the definition of an irregular cycle, it's typically a cycle that is varying more than 8 days from cycle to cycle. So the example that I gave of the cycle being 27 days, one cycle, and then, you know, 32 days and then 29 days or whatever, that would be considered normal variation because it's not varying more than 8 days from cycle to cycle. But for other women, if they're having a cycle that like mine were, although mine weren't necessarily irregular, they were just long, but they would meet the definition because they were over 35 days. And sometimes it would be 42 days and sometimes it would be, you know, 29 days. And so if we are having this more than 8 days variation, that is what is meeting that definition of irregular. And if we look at the period usually averages about 5 days or so, with a range of about 3 to 7, starting moderate to heavy and then kind of gradually tapering off. I always say a period should have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and then be over, like a sentence, as opposed to just continuing on. You shouldn't have bleeding all throughout your cycle. That would be something we would want to be looking at. And it's very common for women to have spotting, like before their period, but it doesn't make it optimal to have that, some of that spotting that's happening. And, you know, large clots, a lot of women have that, but that doesn't make it optimal, doesn't make it something that we should be expecting. And also pain. A lot of women have, you know, moderate to severe pain with their period, but we should have a conversation about just because it's common doesn't make it optimal. And we really should be looking at pain as a significant problem. It's only periods and childbirth. I mean, childbirth is a little bit different, but outside of childbirth, it's only really periods that are can be so painful, and we could actually as a culture think that this is completely fine. I always say, like, if a man had like moderate to severe pain in his penis for a couple days every month, no one would be like, yeah, it's cool. It's just part of being a man. Like,
just suck it up. Go back to work. Yeah. Right? Oh my gosh. That's so funny. I mean, that just highlights even, I'm sure you know this work too, but in the studies of trying to make male birth control, I know the one study that they did recently, it was like just a few participants had a low libido as a side effect, and they canceled the whole study. Yeah, whereas like low libido. Whereas females
safety
libidos,
committee. Yeah. They had us, I'm just like, what is happening? How did these like six men, it wasn't six, but like how did these men in the study have a safety committee? And like this whole uncontrolled experiment of birth control has literally been going on since 1960.
I know. And you know, I haven't been speaking a lot about it recently, but a huge passion of mine is low libido and women. And so much of it stems back to birth control for a lot of women. And it's even going to the doctor. I remember when I went to an OB-GYN once and I told her about my low libido. And this was early on in my investigation of what was going on. And she literally just said, "Welcome to womanhood." That was literally her answer. I'm just like, this is crazy. And if a man said that, they'd be like, what's wrong? Like, something's wrong. You know, it's just, it's so funny how different it is. But back to the cycle, that's amazing. And I think it is important because so many of the resources that women see online are like 28-day cycle. And even the calendar method of birth control, which is not the same as fertility awareness, which I'm sure you can speak to, where people are just kind of looking at the dates and being like, oh, people have 28-day cycles, so you ovulate on day 14, you know, and that's not accurate because that might not be what's going on with your body. And that's why tracking your body is so important. And that's why a lot of accidental pregnancies can happen that way. And I think people are maybe confused about the difference between those because everyone is slightly different, but there is what is optimal. I love how you say that. What is optimal and what are signs that there's something going on? So I think for a woman listening to this, no matter where they are along their journey, you know, really starting to pay attention to their cycle and their period. I think it's become more common that women start to pay attention, or maybe I just feel that way because I work in the fertility space. But I remember, you know, early in my life, I mean, I wouldn't even know when I'd go to the doctor and they'd say, when was your last period? I would have no idea. I'm like, I don't know. It could have been 100 days ago or like last week. I don't even know, you know, and we just weren't paying attention. So that's the first step, is to just pay attention and start tracking to see these patterns. So what do you recommend for women who are maybe new to this conversation of even knowing if they have a 28-day or a 34-day cycle, or if it's a regular cycle to cycle, like what are kind of the first steps that you recommend for women to take to start to learn about this?
Yeah, I mean, there's different levels. So not everybody has to go like all the way down the rabbit hole to the deep fertility awareness charting scenario that I'm involved in. But for anyone who's just wanting to get their toes deep in, I think there's a zillion charting apps. It's actually amazing to see how much things have changed. I feel old now. Because when I first started charting, it was closer to like the year 2000, because that's the year I graduated high school. And there were no apps. There was nothing. There was no Facebook. There was like nothing. There was no smartphones. And so I used an old-fashioned Excel spreadsheet, you know what I mean? And so it's a lot different now. So the good news is there's so many options. You can do something as simple as a period tracking app. For someone who's wanting to kind of just start to understand the nuances of the cycle beyond just tracking your period, I think a good place to start is just starting to pay attention to your cervical fluid. So if you're not, you know, currently on a hormonal birth control method that would prevent you from making fertile quality cervical mucus, then you can just start paying attention. So it could be as simple as like, you know, we all go to the bathroom many times a day. So you can just start to pay attention to those couple of days where it actually does feel more wet down there, or if you're wiping and it feels slippery, or you notice the stuff in your underwear. Cervical fluid can look like creamy white hand lotion. It can look like clear, stretchy, raw egg whites. And it's, you know, interesting anecdotally that some women, because no one has taught this information, think that it's a recurring infection. So there's women who literally go to their doctors that think they have an infection and maybe even get antibiotics if the doctor doesn't do a swab, you know, and just prescribes it. So that's something, it's normal and healthy to have this cervical fluid. And when you start to pay attention, what you would expect is after your period starts to come to an end, if you're paying attention, you may have a few days that we call dry days before you start to see anything, but then you'll typically start to see this fluid. And then once you reach ovulation, and you have ovulated, typically the fluid dries up entirely or significantly decreases or changes. So even just that information can be really helpful. So those days of cervical fluid are your fertile days, because the sperm can survive for up to 5 days when you have cervical fluid before ovulation. And then after you've confirmed ovulation, I mean, for people who are wanting to take this further, if they've had a negative side effect situation from hormonal birth control and they're wanting to actually use this method for birth control, there's additional rules and a buffer period that you would put on the end of this. But you can also take it that far and learn how to use it as a birth control method. And when you're using a specific method, the most accurate and heavily studied would be the symptothermal method. For example, that's very common, although there are other methods. There's a variety of different methods. But many fertility awareness educators like myself will quote the 99.4% efficacy stat for perfect use. And that is when the symptothermal method is used. So anyway, so that kind of takes you through the gamut. It could be as simple as period tracking. You could just start paying attention to your cervical fluid, or you could go full throttle and choose a method and start to really learn how to track.
I love that. Do you have any favorite apps or programs right now? I know it changes every time. Even since my first course that I wrote, I'm like, oh my gosh, like all of the technology has changed. I have to like update it. But do you have any favorites right now as 2024?
So I really feel like I should be more on top of it, because like you said, there are new apps every day all the time. Mm-hmm. So I mean, what I typically use with my clients and what my practitioners use with their clients is the Read Your Body app. And so the reason that we've chosen that one is because it was designed by women who are pretty like they're geeking out on fertility awareness in particular. So it's highly customizable, and it's designed with templates for many of the common fertility awareness based methods. So the fact that it's highly customizable can be challenging, because then there's so many options, right? And if you're brand new, it's like, oh my gosh, like what do I do?
Yeah.
But when with myself, for example, I've created a template that my clients can actually download to use with it. So they just get those settings right away. So it's also just a very useful app from that perspective, because even though there's all these choices, if you choose to use it, or if you use it with like your clients, you can actually, it's pretty easy to set up, but you can like set up a template and have, and just kind of give it to them and set them off to the races.
That's awesome. Yeah, I used Kendara forever. That was sort of like my favorite app back in the day. They used to have a thermometer that paired with it, but I don't
think
they do anymore.
That was the first one. That was like the first. I remember I interviewed the founder. Mm-hmm. He sold the company since then. Like, this was so long ago. But yeah, like that was like the first like fertility awareness specific obsessed app. And they did come out with their Wink thermometer. I don't know what happened to the Wink.
I know it's because again, that was in my cycle tracking course, and I've had to go edit it because I'm like, oh, that doesn't exist anymore. And I'm like, this is so annoying. And then I think some people use Natural Cycles. I haven't dove deeper into that, but just for some people, like there's lots out there. But the important thing, I'm sure you would reiterate, is some apps don't allow you to track your symptoms or your temperature.
Yeah.
Some of the more popular apps, they're more just like, when did your period start? And they'll give you information about your period. But if you're not able to put in your symptoms or your cervical fluid or your temperature, then it's not very helpful, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you're hitting on like the difference between a simple period tracker app and then a fertility awareness based app. So
yeah,
it depends on what you're wanting to track. So there's who knows how many period tracker apps there are out there. And those would have limited options for other different symptoms. And then you do have fertility awareness specific apps that allow you to track your basal body temperature and cervical position. Some of the kind of like the apps that I tend toward, like the Kendara or the Read Your Body or some of the newer ones, allow you a lot of customizability. So you can actually track whatever you want. So you can add in custom lines and track your sleep patterns or breast tenderness or any of that kind of stuff. So I know that's really popular. And I mean, when choosing an app for people who are wanting to use fertility awareness, one of the big things that I always just talk about is many of these apps are programmed with algorithms to tell you when you're fertile. So they'll kind of tell you when you're supposed to be ovulating or tell you when your period is supposed to be coming. And there's also a lot of apps that are evidence-based. So they have these algorithms, they've been tested, and they say, like, use this app for birth control and, you know, it'll be effective for you and things like that. And so, I mean, that's a whole conversation, but I'm biased because I know that the app doesn't know what's in your underwear today.
I know.
So I would say that I think these tools are really, really great. In my perfect world, women would pair the use of the tools with their own knowledge, and they wouldn't necessarily rely entirely on that app. Because what can happen, like what happens with my clients? So, you know, I choose apps that don't have the predictor setting because my goal is to have women feel confident enough to be able to identify their fertile days and things like that. And I'm old school. That's one of the reasons.
Yeah.
But also you feel more confident if you know. So, for example, if you have, a client and she's like tracking her cycle and then the app tells her that something different should be happening today, all of a sudden she's like confused, questioning herself and all of that. So that's just something to be aware of. But I also have clients who keep the predictor settings on, even though they themselves are quite confident, because they find it to be fun to kind of see, like, is it going to get it this month? But that's a little bit different because then they're informed and they're using the app's predictions, like, not really as their marching orders.
Yeah, I love that. I teach that to my patients and clients too, that I want you to know your body and how it all works. Because even something like, let's say you travel or you have a really stressful month, your body's going to shift before that app ever picks it up. The algorithm doesn't know that that happened. And so you might actually have an accidental pregnancy if you're not actually paying attention to your own body's symptoms. And so they are super helpful for sure. But to rely on them solely, I think, is a little dangerous, especially when using it for birth control. So let's talk about birth
control.
Can I
interject with that for a second? Yeah. Because when I first started teaching, I had this mindset like, well, you can't mess it up if you're trying, but you can. So I would add that it can also mess you up when you're trying, because if your app tells you that you're going to ovulate on day 15 or whatever, but you see that cervical fluid on day 6 or day 7 and you think to yourself, well, I've never ovulated this early, so I'm just going to ignore that cervical fluid, you could legit miss that opportunity if it happens to be an early ovulation. So it does work both ways, and it is important for both, whether you're trying or avoiding, to be aware of those differences between what your body's saying and what the app might be saying.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, just as like a thing, you know, people just don't realize, I think, sometimes that ovulation, whether it's normal or optimal or not, like Dr. Morgan, the co-host of this podcast, she ovulates on like day 10 of her cycle and I ovulate on like day 18. So we're an entire week apart, you know, and if we were going off the classic 14-day ovulation, we would both be missing that window, which our situation, you know, I can't get pregnant naturally with my husband because of his sperm, but if I could, you know, it's still important. And I knew when I ovulated. And so I think that's a huge stretch. And so for people who are just like, yeah, we just kind of have sex around day 14. And this is why it's so important to learn your own tracking and what's going on. And even with the apps, they might not be accurate. So thanks for bringing
that up.
And
even with your situation, you could have an ovulation on day 12 randomly in a 1 to 2 year period, even if it was not, it had never happened before. And your colleague could also have a day 16 ovulation, one cycle, even though it had never happened. And so I'm like the annoying fertility awareness educator, but I've just done this work for so long that when you chart yourself for a very long time, and when you have clients who chart over years, then everybody has a short one and a long one. So for example, at the end of each year, the reason I knew that my average was about 38 days is because in my old charts, my paper charts, I found them, I put a pretty cover, it was super fun. I would write down all of the numbers, like the number of days. And you can calculate, like, because I'm a nerd, right? So the median, mean, and mode. And it's really fascinating to do that. You might have, like, 1 year my mode was like 29 days. That was like the most frequent number that I had. But the longest cycle, because, you know, maybe there's a stressful event or something, the longest cycle, I had one cycle that was like day like 42 days. And then my shortest cycle might have been 27 days. So I think that that's also really important for everybody to wrap their heads around. Because as soon as you, like, we think we get charting, right, when we're charting. But many of us fall into rhythm method thinking. We can't help it.
Yeah.
We want to know when we usually ovulate. We want to know how long. We want these patterns. And we want to feel like we're in tune with our body. But that can make it so that when something happens that's outside of that, we're super confused and really stressed.
Yeah. And that's really important with birth control. So let's talk about that, because this is, you know, if you choose not to use hormonal birth control, which let's just talk a little bit about that first, and then we'll talk about using fertility awareness and tracking as birth control, because that's not somewhere you want to make a mistake or just rely on like, well, I think this is what's happening. So can you just speak a little bit to hormonal birth control and why maybe it's not the best for every woman, you know, as we've kind of been told in our society as our form of birth control, and how that potentially impacts us and our fertility?
Yeah, I mean, huge question. Like, yep, that could be
a whole podcast.
Exactly. I'll try to focus on just a couple main points. I think one thing to consider with the birth control pill. So I think it's helpful to say. So I'll start by saying that the birth control pill was the first medication that was ever on the market designed to shut down a perfectly normal bodily function in a healthy human being. Yeah. Like, before that, all medication was designed for illnesses. Right? So that's just, let's just start there. Mm-hmm. So the pill is, the main modes of action are so there's different types of hormonal contraceptives, right? Like, there's the IUDs, there's the shots, there's the implants. But so they fall into different categories, but all of them, although they don't all, you know, have all three kind of main modes of action, they typically do have a combination. So the main mode of action for most hormonal contraceptives is to suppress ovulation, obviously, because if you're not ovulating, you can't get pregnant. And that's one of the reasons why it's so effective. So, you know, it does that by interfering with the communication between the hypothalamus, pituitary, and ovaries. And so in that way, just think about that for a minute. It just suppresses ovulation. It kind of puts your ovaries in a state of rest. And that means that they're not pumping out those natural hormones. So, you know, second mode of action is that it causes the uterine lining to be quite thin and not receptive to a fertilized egg. And then it also prevents your cervix from producing fertile quality cervical mucus. So you're always, the cervix would then be plugged with a thick mucus plug pretty much all the time. So from that perspective, I do think that just when you're thinking about this, like on a philosophical level, if you are shutting down your fertility, often for years on end, we have this idea that our menstrual cycle is only about reproduction and that we can kind of just shut it on and off. So that piece, I mean, I could talk about that further, but I think from a practical standpoint, what we need to understand is that when you come off of hormonal contraceptives, particularly if you've used them long-term, and interestingly, most research papers define long-term as like 2 years or more. And so many mm-hmm. women are using the pill for like 10, 15 years, right?
Right.
So there is this period of subfertility post-pill. Mm-hmm. It's a temporary period of subfertility, and it's measured in different ways. So, you know, there's some studies that just show that when women are using the pill, at least it takes about twice as long for conception to happen. So one study, it was like 4 months for couples who were using condoms versus 8 months to conception for people who were using the pill versus 15 to 18 months for people who were using the shot. So just mm-hmm. put that out there. The scary stats, there's a couple stats that I share in my books of resources that are like the scary stats that freak people out. So one of those is that when a woman's on the pill, her ovarian reserve parameters are known to be a lot lower. So AMH levels are lower, ovarian volume is lower, and antral follicle count is lower. And that takes about 6 to 7 months or more to kind of restore and normalize. So mm-hmm. I think one of the good things, and, you know, this is potentially a little bit debatable because people have different opinions about it, but when I'm looking at the research, there's very little evidence to suggest that the pill has this long-term negative effect on fertility. So, but there are these other kind of side effects. So there's the subfertility, period of subfertility that women are not aware of. And I think that that sets a lot of women up for some issues. So for example, most women have been told that they could get pregnant at any time, and they spend the majority of their lives, particularly their like late teens, early 20s, actively avoiding pregnancy. So they're expecting, even if it's subconsciously, to get pregnant immediately when they're off of it. I mean, I know people who got pregnant while they're still taking it, right?
Yeah.
So we're expecting that. So when pregnancy doesn't happen in month one and month two and month three, you're already freaked out by month five and month six, let alone month 12. And nobody told you about this period of subfertility. So many of us have not planned ahead by taking, coming off of the pill a bit sooner. So that's one issue. And then I would say another issue is that we're not told anything about our fertility and age. So while the pill might be a perfectly reasonable option for someone who's in their early 20s, it might be controversial, but, you know, in my books, I often say things, and when I'm having these kinds of conversations, I'll say that, you know, when you're getting to your late 20s and early 30s and like mid 30s, like, maybe we should be thinking about if this is still the best option for you, because when you're already in your 30s, you don't necessarily have that year of subfertility, like time to restore your cycles. Like, you might need to consider shifting to a different type of birth control method so that when you're ready to conceive, your body doesn't also need time to adjust. Yeah. So that's something. And then there was one other thing that I wanted to share that I thought was important that has now escaped me. So maybe come back.
It'll pop back.
Let's take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors. Did you know that 97% of women in the US take a prenatal supplement, yet 95% plus are still deficient in key nutrients? My favorite prenatal is from a company called Needed because they dose nutrients at levels to not just meet the bare minimum as most prenatals do. They actually use form of nutrients and dosages that allow mama and baby to thrive. Needed actually approached me years ago and asked me if I could help them design the perfect prenatal because they knew that the current prenatals available were not actually helping women. We spent over 3 years diving into the research and understanding what practitioners are seeing and what women actually need at this important season before we formulated this amazingly supportive option. It's no wonder over 4,000 practitioners now recommend Needed, something I am very proud of. If you have followed me for a while, you know that prenatals and optimizing nutrients starts long before pregnancy. So no matter where you are along your fertility or motherhood journey, Needed is the brand I recommend. Head to thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% on your first order. Again, visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20%. Okay, back to the show.
I love that. So yeah, I think one thing for people to know, everyone has the person that they know that they stopped birth control and got pregnant right away. You know, a lot of what I teach is how important it is to replenish the body and all of the imbalances that birth control can create. So we don't necessarily want to conceive right away after stopping birth control. And so, you know, are there other options, like you mentioned, especially for women who want to feel empowered in their cycle or maybe are moving into their 30s, where they can use something like fertility awareness and cycle tracking as a birth control, where the minute you're ready to conceive, you can just conceive. Like, there's no period of time of waiting. So can you kind of speak to what that would look like? I think some women get really nervous, maybe thinking about getting off the pill. I have a breaking up with birth control course, and some of the women in there are like, I'm so like nervous, you know, because we are so taught from teenagers on that this is the safety blanket, quote unquote, that, you know, somewhat protects us from pregnancy, and they're trying to learn this new way of understanding their body. But can you kind of speak to what that looks like and how effective it is when you actually do it correctly?
Yeah, I mean, that's huge. And there's so much that we could say. I feel like to start off, we really have to talk about the programming. And I remember being terrified all the time. And I was just so young, but the sex ed class really just didn't provide any information. So I do feel like education is the first piece of it. The way I talk about it with clients often is that there's like three stages of this situation where we actually trust fertility awareness. And stage one has to be when we get our head around the science of it, when we actually understand, like, logically, it doesn't mean we believe it, but we understand logically that we're not fertile every day. So I think that the education piece is really, really important, because when you actually understand what's happening in your cycle and you understand that there are, like, I've had clients who are like, they've listened to my podcast, they've read my book, they're like in my class. And I'm like, okay, so, you know, after ovulation, we confirm ovulation with a cross check. So we compare your basal body temperature to your mucus. And then in the second half of your cycle, once you've confirmed ovulation with that cross check, pregnancy is impossible, meaning there's a zero chance of pregnancy because the egg is dead and gone. Your vagina is literally acidic, killing sperm, and your cervix is blocked with a thick mucus plug. So this is like happening in the conversation. I have a client, you know, she raises her hand or whatever, and she's like, so what do you mean? Like it can't get pregnant. Like when you say unprotected sex, like, do you mean like with withdrawal? Like she's like,
can't,
right? And so this is one thing where the programming is so, so, so deep that we have a really hard time getting our head around the fact that no, like literally impossible. So the first step is really understanding that logically to the point that it makes sense in your mind. I would say the second stage is when you start charting and you start to actually see your cycle and see ovulation and mucus and temperature and like not just one chart, like you see that happening in cycle two and you see it happening in cycle three. You start to realize that you just didn't know that your body was doing this thing. Yeah. Like your body was just doing this thing repeatedly. And now you know. And the cyclicity of our cycles. So I talk about a lot understanding your patterns, which is not I ovulate on day 18. It's like, not that I'm saying that there's anything wrong with that, but I'm saying that understanding your patterns when I talk about that means how long is your period typically and what is it typically like? How many days do you typically have after your period before you start to see mucus? How many days of mucus do you typically have, right? And then how long is your luteal phase typically? So when I'm talking about these patterns, I'm obviously trying to get people away from the specific date so that there's room for fluctuation when you have that earlier or later ovulation. So I'm very careful how I speak about it. But it also, there's cyclicity to this. And with that cyclicity allows us to start to feel more confident. Because again, it's not just like we're not rabbits or, you know, there's species of animals that like ovulate in response to sexual arousal and stuff. And fortunately, we're not them. So you don't have to worry about stuff like that. Like when you understand the hormone cycle and the fact that you're not just going to like ovulation is not this terrorist event, just like boom, 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 right? Where you understand it's like, okay, their follicles have to develop. And as they develop, they're releasing estrogen. And that estrogen is what is stimulating the cervical crypts to make the cervical mucus. And that's what's causing the uterine lining to build. And when you can, I feel like this has been really helpful in my practice because this is like the talking, I joke that like 90% of the job is talking your clients off the ledge, right? Mm-hmm. So like, this is part of like, no one educated you about this. And it's unfortunate that you're literally like, whether it's 25, 30, 35, 42, it's unfortunate that we're learning it now, but at least we're learning it now. And the more we can understand the science part of it, and get our heads around it, like that's the first step. And then the second step is to start to chart and actually see this in action. So we see that it's real. But even that doesn't make you trust it fully in your bones. Once you're there and you know all the rules and you've taken the time to learn, maybe you're working with an instructor, it's when you have sex on a infertile day. I encourage my clients to start with their post-ovulatory phase. Like there's a whole staging process. When you do that, and then you're terrified and what have I done and I'm going to be pregnant and then your period comes and then you do that again. And now I'm like 20 something years in. So like I know it works, but you can't get there. You have to start with step one and then step two and step three. So hopefully that answers the at least part of it. But it's also just to recognize how scary it is. And then the other thing too is educate about other non-hormonal methods for some reason. So you know, I mentioned that I graduated high school in 2000. So that's dating me. It seems like the younger generation, like they're being taught that condoms don't work. And like, what is happening? So there's a lot of people that like, they can't even like trust a condom and they can't. So I think there's a lot of education also about the alternative methods and how to manage the fertile window and like to have a plan, to have a conversation with your partner. A lot of young women, very young. Now, I shouldn't say that as a generalization. I've worked with some younger women who are actually quite just uncomfortable maybe having some of these conversations with their partners. So part of it as well is like in order for fertility awareness to work, like your partner does have to be on board. And so some people would say that's a positive and some people might say that it's a negative, right? Depending on their perspective. But we have to kind of just have the conversations and figure out what is the biggest thing that you're afraid of. Is your partner on board? Like, are you... Do you understand? Like, are you good with the science part of it? Like, you have to kind of get into that. Like, what are you, like, what is the biggest concern here? And that's how we then figure out, like, what education information our clients need in order for them to feel a little bit more comfortable. And, you know, I lean heavily on the science because that is where we have the information. You know, as I mentioned, the symptothermal method, there's a study, very popular, you know, study among fertility awareness educators showing a 99.4% efficacy rate. In that study, they used a double check pre-ovulatory option to open the fertile window. So they're relying on cervical mucus, but also a last pre-ovulatory infertile day calculation. Mm-hmm. So there is a calculation element to make sure that you have a buffer typically between Like, so you're not ever just having sex right up until the day before you ovulate. So you have two signs to compare against always. And similarly in the post-op, as I mentioned, the temperature and cervical position. So I've leaned quite heavily into the science aspect of that to try to help people feel a little bit more confident. And then when they're learning to chart, one of the things that I teach my clients and like my practitioners also who I train to kind of help their clients, we also have like a learning curve where we take our clients through like step one, we have to chart without having any unprotected sex for at least one cycle, sometimes more, so that you can get a sense of what's going on. Like, we don't just, it's not an IUD. Like, you don't just like get it in and then go and start having sex. Like, you can with an IUD, but like you have to learn first. And then once you understand the charting part and you're comfortable confirming ovulation and you have some of these ovulation basics down, then we can move on to the post-ovulatory phase, because we know that that is the phase where pregnancy is totally impossible. The only part of the cycle that pregnancy is possible is the first half. So then once we've mastered those aspects, then we move on to the pre-ovulatory phase and we talk about the calculation plus the mucus so that you can, again, feel really, really confident. So, you know, I know I feel like I've been chatting a whole lot about this, but my goal is to have my clients feel as confident and solid as possible, because ultimately this is a valid option, but it's only going to help people when they feel really confident and they have the information that they need to use it in the most effective way possible.
Yeah, I love that. It is definitely a more active form of birth control. And, you know, maybe that's not the best fit for every person, but I know for me, when I started becoming sexually active in college, I was never presented this as an option. And I was a very motivated, science-driven person. I would have loved to have been told that this was an option because I would have done it very well. I just didn't even know it was a choice, right? And I was just put on the pill. And I think what you said about having your partners on board is really important and something that, you know, it's so tricky, the birth control conversation, because everyone is really different. And, you know, you have to be a person, like, let's say you are young, let's say you're in college, you're sexually active, and maybe you don't even have a specific partner. You have to know your body well enough and have enough, I don't even know what the word is, like gumption or confidence to know, okay, I am like in my fertile window, like I'm using a condom. It doesn't matter what the partner that I'm with says, it doesn't matter what he cares about. I can't be a people pleaser. This isn't like a time where I'm like, well, maybe it's okay, where you could maybe do that when you're on hormonal birth control. And so I think, like, to your point, you know, some people might be like, oh my God, this is just too much, I'm too scared. But for people who maybe have one partner, and I think it's totally possible to still do it, you just need to know that. You know, because I know that there were many times, especially with friends of mine in college too, where it's like they just didn't stand up for themselves enough to say, like, I don't care what you want, male partner, we're using a condom, or like, this is what's happening. And like having that sort of energy and mentality around it. And when you are maybe in a committed relationship, you just have a single partner, making sure that they feel the same, you know, because I think a lot of men in my experience don't love using condoms, but you, if you choose to have sex during any time where you could be fertile, like you have to with this method. And so that's something that you need to have a conversation about. And I don't know. It needs
I love talking about this stuff because I feel like sometimes we need to give permission to other women to, like, sometimes we're like waiting for someone to give us permission to do things. Mm-hmm. So one thing about what you said as well, I always say, like, no one's forcing anyone to use fertility awareness. Like, women self-select this method. So I feel like for women who are listening to this conversation, a lot of women kind of feel like called to do this. Like, they feel like this is for me. Like, this is what I've been looking for. So I feel like just trust that, you know, if it doesn't feel right for you, I would never stand up in front of a group of people and say everybody should chart their cycles or whatever, because it's not true. Everybody shouldn't. It's not about that. Just like I wouldn't say everybody should use, like, everyone has to make a decision about what's best for them. So I think that's one thing that's really useful to consider. Now, for me, I'm going to share my personal experience in case that is helpful. So as I mentioned, when I actually needed birth control, I came off of the pill. And so I have literally never had an experience, TMI, whatever day this is. I've never had a sexual experience with a partner on the pill. So like there was never an option. Like, so that, like, just to put it out there, like, it is possible. So any type of interaction there, like, it, and also, like, I grew up in the I was in high school in the 90s. Like, they were on about HIV the whole time. So like, what is amazing to me is that everyone's out there having sex without condoms. Know, and like, STIs don't exist anymore. Like, you guys are afraid of gonorrhea. So like, I know. We don't talk about syphilis anymore. Like, no one's afraid of like herpes. Like, we're just done with this conversation. Like, we're just, so like, there's part of me that's like, I'm entering into like, I'm in my 40s now. Like, I feel like I'm like entering into like a different energy around this stuff where it's almost like someone's grandmother, like, what is happening? So I would love to give everybody permission to put your partners on blast. And, you know, like, I used to send my boyfriends, like, when things, when I, like, when we reached boyfriend status and like, it's serious, there was, first of all, there was no like unprotected sex until we were at that stage. I would send them to the doctor and have them swabbed. Like, what you want to do? You want to put that where? Like, you're going to have to get that thing swabbed.
Yeah,
like, what are we talking about? So anyway, so hopefully that is helpful to people, but it's just useful to hear different perspectives on it, because I recognize exactly what you're saying. I've worked with many clients of over all kinds of different ages, and I've had many conversations with clients who are so nervous to bring their partners into this conversation. Now, yes, some men are jerks, and frankly, they probably shouldn't gain access to your jewels.
I was going to say,
however,
find a different partner.
Most men are not jerks. I feel confident in saying that, because of all of these women that I've worked with over the years, like, I have this silly thing that I, like, most men, like the good guys, they're just happy that you're like willing to take your clothes off.
You know
exactly. Like, they're just like,
really? Like, whatever we need to do.
And so, like, if he's like, so that's a whole conversation. But I, this is why, with fertility awareness and the way I've designed my programs, like, these kinds of conversations are always, always part of the program, because they have to be, because we need to set women up for success and have those conversations to, if necessary, give permission to just like, and especially it's also kind of interesting, because a lot of women have been in a relationship with a partner for a while, and now they're wanting to switch it up. So part of their nervousness is that now there's going to have to be new rules. Like, before, there was unfettered access, and now we have to have a change of conversation. But you know what? Sometimes when women come off the pill, they regain their libido, and all of a sudden they want to have more sex. So, like, sometimes it's actually like you're afraid, but it's better, because now you want it more, and your partner gets to benefit from that, even though there's times when you have to use protection and you have to sort out what you're going to do. So there's both sides to this coin.
And I want to highlight now, because we've kind of talked about the younger women, you know, a lot of accidental pregnancies happen in the perimenopausal time or postpartum, right? So after women have had a baby. So can we just speak to that? I know we're like coming up on time, but we could talk forever depending on your schedule. Can we just talk, because I get a lot of questions about this. Dr. Morgan gets a lot of questions. I'm sure you do, about, okay, I've had a baby. I've had two, three, whatever. Maybe you're like Dr. Morgan, who's had four and she knows she's done, but doesn't want to go on the pill. And her husband's maybe not super stoked about a vasectomy. Like, is it possible to use cycle tracking once you've had children, postpartum, into the perimenopausal time? Because, you know, when I think about this idea of condom use too, or protection, sometimes it is in couples who've had 10 years of unprotected sex, totally free reign, because they're just having babies, they're doing all this stuff, but now they know they're done. And is this still a possibility, and how does that look different for a woman in that season of her life?
I mean, that's such a great question. It is possible. It's just that you have to actually like chart your cycle. And one of the things that changes, so we talked a little bit about what the cycle parameters look like. Now, those are cycle parameters kind of overall. If we can break it down and talk a little bit about cycle parameters for women within the first 2 or 3 years after menarche, because that's a little bit different. Cycles tend to be a little bit longer and a little bit more regular. And we have what one researcher termed the middle life phase. And so that's kind of like the majority of your reproductive life. But about 10 years before your last period, when you head into that premenopause phase, we start to see some changes. One of those changes is that some women notice that they start ovulating earlier, like your colleague, and cycles start to shorten. And so instead of the average cycle length being like 29 days, the average cycle length during that phase could be like 26 days. So one of the challenges I think that many women face in the premenopause, especially if they were charting before and they were kind of rhythmy, because they're like, well, I always ovulate on da 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 da. Because what happens is when that ovulation starts creeping, like they're taking chances in that pre-ov, and that's why some of these pregnancies are happening. So it is possible, but like anybody who I would say, okay, if you're using this as your primary birth control method and you're wanting to take this quite seriously, I do recommend that anybody who really wants to use this as a primary birth control considers having at least a few sessions with a certified instructor, because you will have questions and you do need to have that opportunity to learn. Because with charting, it's really not about knowing when you're like, it's not about knowing. So we have this lovely idea that we're going to be, you know, we're going to understand our bodies, or we're just going to know things, but it's not about that. It's literally about our observations. And we have to actually switch that part of our mindset to really understand that this is a system. It's based on observation, and we have to know that. So that's the first thing, that it is possible. It's important to have that background information to know how your cycles change with age. And even postpartum, it's helpful to know that if you're still breastfeeding and your cycles are, you know, returning, well, first of all, pregnancy is possible before you get your first period. Mm-hmm. So it is helpful to learn a bit about cervical fluid and to be aware of that. And if you're wanting to use this as a method of birth control, you need to understand it. So again, that's a situation where I'd recommend working with an instructor a little bit so that you can at least understand. Most women who chart their cycles use temperature almost as a primary. And many women never understand mucus. So when you're postpartum, when I talk about postpartum, I divide it into phase one and two. So phase one would be after the lochia stops. So after like the postpartum bleeding stops, you enter into potentially, if you're breastfeeding, a very long pre-ovulatory phase where you're like legit on mucus watch, sometimes for months. And so if you don't know, or if you're not tracking and you're not used to tracking without temperature, when you jump into that mucus phase that leads up to ovulation, like you have no warning. And maybe after several months of breastfeeding, you're tired, baby wake ups, like all of a sudden you feel, you know, you got that libido and your husband's like, it's so interesting how many people be like, we just had sex that one time. but it's like, yeah, of course you did, because that one time, like, you had a libido, like
you wanted,
and you were
to.
Giving pheromones. Like there's pheromones that you give off that you don't even have control over. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, like if there was going to be one time, it's probably going to be then anyway. We have to be aware of this stuff and know about it. And then when we enter into what I call phase two, so after we actually start ovulating again, if you're still breastfeeding, the duration and frequency of suckling is what has that suppressive effect on ovulation. And so if your baby is sick a little bit, or, you know, going through one of those wonder weeks, or you're pulling them back into bed or nursing, whatever, you can still have some cycle irregularities. So it's possible. It's just that you have to be committed to track, or when you're in doubt, which could be a lot, if you're not tracking consistently, you have to know what you're going to do as an alternative. And a controversial thing, I probably shouldn't even say it, you know, a lot of couples kind of like, they don't talk about it, but couples use condoms, they use withdrawal, they use a combination. Sometimes they use, you know, withdrawal with a diaphragm, or they use condoms and they withdraw as well or whatever. You just have to kind of have those conversations with your partner, determine what you are comfortable with. And some couples use alternative sex during their fertile window where they don't have, you know, intercourse specifically. So you have to just decide, is this the right option for me? Is my partner on board? And what am I going to do when I'm in doubt? Or, you know, am I willing to consider working with an instructor? All of those kinds of things.
I love that. So I just want to highlight for people who maybe didn't catch it, for people who maybe don't understand the cycle super well. So when you're saying postpartum, you, and you can clarify me on this, you, if you are used to tracking your cervical fluid, then you would know, because the cervical changes happen prior and up to ovulation, you would know that ovulation is coming, it's imminent, before, because it's going to be 2 weeks after that, that you would actually get a period. So how you're saying that women can get pregnant before they ever get a period, if you are learning how to track your cervical mucus, then you could potentially catch an ovulation before, you know, you would ever know that you're ovulating. And so that's, I think, something for people to pay attention to. And I think you teach a lot about cervical mucus. Can you just speak a little bit to that? And is there ever a time, like, can you ovulate without cervical mucus, you know, like postpartum or even after birth control? Like, is there ever a time when you can be dry and still ovulating? Because I've had patients ask me that question before, and I would love to know what you say about that.
Yes, great question. So specifically postpartum, so there are situations that can cause like low mucus. One of them is antihistamine use, for example, you know, because if you think about, you're taking medication to make your nose stop running. So postpartum, I would say, is more rare to, you know, to have no mucus when you're ovulating. There's a couple of reasons for that, unless you were using antihistamines actively.
Okay.
So there is a possibility for sure. Yeah. But the reason I say that is because really interestingly, when you are pregnant and you're, you know, you're producing these really high levels of progesterone, like your estrogen and progesterone levels are quite high during pregnancy, to the point that I would liken it to kind of like a second puberty, because your body totally changes. I mean, you get new breasts at the end of it, breasts that can lactate now.
Sure do.
And one of the effects of this interesting kind of second puberty phase is that it has a rejuvenating effect on the cervical crypt. So I've had a number of clients who, the pill has the opposite effect on the cervical crypts. The pill can... the pill changes the cervical crypts, and I could go into a long description, but suffice it to say that you end up with fewer crypts that make like the clear stretchy mucus. And so it's a scary stat again, that kind of freaks women out when you say that. So what can happen is when you come off the pill, you can have less mucus. And I have had clients come off the pill and they're ovulating for a period of time, but they have very little or no mucus. There's a percentage of women who have that. The point I'm trying to make is that I have had a number of clients who, let's say they came off the pill, they're still making some mucus, but they never really saw like a whole lot. But I've had a number of clients who then, after they have a baby, when their cycles resume postpartum, they're just like, wow, like this is amazing. Mm-hmm. I've never seen this much mucus before. So for that reason, I would say that it's more uncommon for women to not have any mucus postpartum. Gotcha. And when you're tracking, you just have to kind of start paying attention. You're checking daily, you're noting on your app or your chart or whatever that you use, and you're identifying, like, you can't tell in advance when ovulation is going to happen, but you can see when you have mucus and know that those days are fertile. And typically before ovulation, that's when you really get into it and you start to see a lot of mucus. So women who are paying attention to it are just like, wow, because they often see a lot more, especially in those first cycles postpartum. And to answer your question about like dry cycles, so yes, that is possible, but there are certain reasons for it. Whenever I've had clients that have, dry cycles, the example of coming off the pill. So like I said, a small percentage of my clients come off the pill and see no mucus for a few months. I've never seen this just continue on though forever. I've seen it where it's like totally dry for like a few cycles and then the mucus production starts to resume. Mm-hmm. So totally dry cycles I've seen in certain situations, and those situations include, like I said, the antihistamine use, post-pill, low mucus cycles I've seen after cervical, like cervical intervention. So if somebody had abnormal cervical cells and then they had like a procedure, like a LEAP or a colposcopy or something, I've seen like really low mucus in situations like that. And also in clients who are kind of like really restricting their food or exercising a lot, but not enough to stop their cycle entirely, but definitely not enough to have a negative impact on their hormone production. And also just generally clients who have abnormal cervical cells. So that list is not to say that these women have no mucus, because no mucus is less common, like completely dry, but like low mucus where they're not necessarily seeing like a lot of clear, stretchy, or, you know, what have you.
Do you see low mucus in endometriosis cases more or no? Because I know endo can have higher estrogen. I don't know if that plays a role.
I wouldn't say that I've seen a direct correlation. One thing that I can say is that endo is often kind of coinciding with gut type issues. And often that is associated with like abnormal mucus patterns. Like, so women who have like gut issues, I've seen like kind of not necessarily a large quantity of mucus, but like many days.
Gotcha. So more mucus, not less.
Yeah, but not, but it's interesting because you can have many days of mucus, but still not have like abundant mucus on any particular day.
Cervical mucus. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I was just thinking of a particular patient in my mind. Amazing. This is so great. I feel like I could talk to you forever and we could have a whole other podcast about, we haven't even really gotten into the fertility piece. So maybe I'll have you back at some point and we can chat all about that and male fertility. But for so much of what we've talked about, you've mentioned the benefit of working with someone, a coach, someone who can help you track. Can you talk a little bit about that, what you offer, how people can find you, all the things?
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. This conversation was great. I loved all the different places that we went into. So that was a lot of fun.
I tend to do that. Ah, all over the place.
Yeah. It's always fun though, because we get so many like specific things out of it. So it was really fun. So I've shifted my practice a bit. I've mentioned it a few times. I'm working with practitioners primarily these days because it's an interesting shift in my practice. It's just one of those things where, like you said, towards the beginning of the call, it'd be amazing if all women knew about this. And I'm one human being. And so I'm realizing that a bigger impact happens when we empower practitioners to be able to provide the support to clients. So that's what I've been doing a lot of these days. And so we're building out our practitioner directory for people who are looking for, you know, one-on-one clients. And so I am currently offering my Fertility Awareness Mastery mentorship program, where I'm distilling all of that experience and training and research and all the things for our practitioners to be able to apply in their own practices. Obviously, Lily and I just came out with our new book, Real Food for Fertility, which we're both excited for all of the reasons. And I think for her and myself, it's one of those kind of like textbook pieces for our respective practitioner programs. So, I mean, honestly, for years, I was like, oh my gosh, I can't wait till the book comes out because this is totally going to be the textbook. So now I get to like open the book in class and be like, okay.
Yay.
So that's what's going on with me. For anybody who enjoyed this conversation, you can find me. I have my podcast, Fertility Friday. I've been really, it's in its 10th year, which is just crazy.
Oh, that's amazing. Good for you. Oh my gosh. Maureen and I have been doing this for 2 years and I can't even imagine. That's wild.
I just, I kind of just keep thinking like, how old am I? Like, what's happening?
You were just really on it. You were super like on it when you should have been. That's great.
So there's that for podcast, people who love the podcast, and Lily and I are putting the finishing touches on our audiobook. So we're really hoping to get that out shortly. So really excited about that. And you can get the first chapter of Real Food for Fertility from our website, realfoodforfertility.com. So, I mean, thanks again for having me.
Amazing. This was super fun. Oh my gosh. Thank you so much. I'm sure everyone's going to love this episode. So thank you.
Today, we have talked all about the cycle and how to use it to figure out what's going on with our body, potentially use it as birth control, or to use it to help you conceive. It can be really confusing to know what is going on with your cycle, which is why I created a mini course called Master Your Cycle. In this mini course, I break down the science, the hormones, and the physiology of what's going on in your body and teach you how to track your cycle so that you can use Fertility Awareness Method either to learn more about your body, prevent pregnancy, or conceive easily. This is a super easy to understand course. I've broken it down in a really digestible way, and it's a mini course, so it's only $47, which is amazing. If you want to learn more, go to womanhoodwellness.com/mini-courses, and it is listed right there on that page. Again, womanhoodwellness.com/mini-courses. And you can get yours today to learn all about tracking your cycle.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.